This is GamesAtWork.biz with your hosts, Phaedra Boynodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization with which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 55, Do Not Play This Game at Work.
Hello and welcome again to another edition of GamesAtWork.biz. This is Michael Martin, one of the three co-hosts of the show. I'm coming to you live this afternoon, because it's always live for me when I'm recording, from Budapest, Hungary, where it's a gorgeous but hot day here. And I understand there were some big thunderstorms over where my co-hosts in North Carolina are, but maybe not today, Michael, are there?
No, not yet today, but it was a rough and exciting evening, night, early morning, you name it, here in beautiful Durham. And we're really excited. So, Phaedra, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I saw nothing. I didn't see any rain. I saw a few flickers of lightning, but that was about it. So I had a peaceful night.
Oh.
It was lovely. Anyway, we have a very, very exciting show here for you today. I have got a special guest, Tom Grant from Forrester Research, who is also a gaming aficionado, both board and video. And he's here to join us and talk to us about games at work.
Welcome, Tom.
Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Well, thank you. Real pleasure to be here.
So, Tom, maybe to get us started here just a little bit, can you tell us about why Forrester is engaged and interested in this space and your particular angle on it?
Yeah, well, it comes up in a couple of contexts. So I'm an analyst. If you don't know Forrester Research, we do research on software. So we do cover collaboration software, ERP, you name it. I cover software development, so I do things like Agile and Lean and application lifecycle management and so forth. And it's come up in the context of that, in that people are looking for ways to make better, faster decisions, particularly as software development is picking up speed all the time, and the demand for new software is increasing exponentially. And it also comes up, you know, with let's say our friends in the collaboration side of the house, the people who cover collaboration software, like Rob Koplowitz and TJ Kitt, in that there's a need for people to come up with different avenues for collaborating, different modes of collaboration. They're looking for ways to be innovative, but it seems like treading down the same path all the time doesn't make them innovative. So my background actually with games goes way back, aside from just being, as you guys mentioned, a gaming aficionado. I play board games and other things. I also got interested in games, serious games, when I was in grad school and started using them within courses that I was a teaching assistant for or an instructor for as a tool for driving home some of the lessons that we had. And actually one course I taught, it was about just general military strategy and theory, and had the kind of the odd coincidence that that course happened right when Operation Desert Storm happened. And also used a couple of simulations in that course to kind of drive home the points, both of what was happening in the real world as well as what was happening in the classroom.
Wow.
And since then, I've just kind of been, as a side venture, also starting up a website for people to collect information about serious games, particularly success stories.
And what's that URL?
SeriousGamesAtWork.org.
Excellent. just so people who are listening and driving in the car don't have to immediately jump on and pull over and try to click through the show notes.
Yeah, unless they're using a new Motorola X phone, right? They could just have their phone find it for them.
While driving.
Well,
that's when you need
listening.
A head-up display and show it up on the windshield while you're driving, right?
The phone's always listening. So.
You're making me worried about liability now.
Do not try this at home. Actually, try it at home, not in the car.
So you're Tom, just to continue a little more about you too. Your Twitter
handle also has gamer right in it as well. So obviously that's a big part of you and what you do. Anything that you're playing right now or anything that you're like really passionate about that you'd want to share with us so that we could find more time that we need to spend on games ourselves?
Yeah, I've had a little bit of a lull with computer games lately because I moved. So getting a new house was a chore as well as moving into it, especially with all the detritus I carry behind me. And you know, also just had a, you know, kind of a family emergency and so forth, but, slowly getting back to playing things and kind of high on my list right now is I'm kind of a strategy game guy. Mm-hmm. So, Crusader Kings 2 is something I keep starting and not actually getting enough into that I can get momentum with it. And also, Scourge of War Gettysburg, was actually hoping to play that before the 150th anniversary of the actual battle, but wound up having to wait until later. And then tomorrow I'm going to be at the World Wargaming Championship event in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Oh, cool.
It's one of the big game cons here on the East Coast.
Cool.
Oh, that'll be fun. So maybe there'll be another game or three that you get to pick up from that event too.
Yeah.
No, Tom, I had a conversation this past spring with Dan Baden, who's the director of serious games for the Center for Disease Control, and he mm-hmm. also designs board games. So I bet you anything he's going to be there because he's been trying to push his latest United Nations game. So keep your eyes peeled for him. Very cool guy.
Yeah, will do. I mean, I've encountered a couple of people like that, like Doug Whatley, the CEO of Breakaway Games, is a longtime board gamer. One of the old board game companies produced War Games, Avalon Hill, that went out of business.
Oh, I love Avalon Hill. I still have my copy of Diplomacy and War and Peace.
And you still have friends after having talked Diplomacy.
Well, no, that was a game to like lose all your friends. Absolutely. I remember the very, very first time I played it, right? You know, I was Russian. I thought, oh, this is going to work out great. Partnered with Turkey. He moves out in like this third year. I just invade through Turkey. And like two turns later, I am wiped off the board.
Also, for the listeners, do not play this game at work. We tried it once, doing like a turn every couple of days, and it just like all free time got consumed by paranoia.
Oh yeah,
what people are going to be doing to each other. So don't do that.
It definitely teaches you something, and it's not trust.
No. Another guy I know who's going to be at WBC, the event I'm going to this weekend, is Mark Herman. I don't know if you know that name, but he's a longtime war game designer. And also he works for Booz Allen, has a kind of a business wargaming practice there. So, yeah, there's definitely overlap between the worlds.
Cool. Very cool.
Absolutely. And Michael, I know that, you know, when you're working on your game design, you know, the first thing you were doing was actually creating a board game yourself of the game that you were looking to put onto iOS.
Oh, so. Absolutely. That's, you know, you got to test out the logic and make sure the rules make sense. And actually the board game was kind of fun, but not as fun as I wanted it to be, which caused me to kind of rethink a lot of the game.
So moving into the topic of the show, I think that's a great segue opportunity there for us is talking about fun and games. And there was a post that we had from a listener asking the bigger question of, do games at work really help productivity? And the research that has been done here is really looking at the concept of whether or not games that are fun and help productivity, if they are becoming mandatory fun, you will play this game, you will like it, maybe you won't like it. At what point does the game become work and not fun and therefore not helping productivity? So I thought this was an extremely intriguing question because this is something that we've talked about on a couple of different occasions. And I'm curious to know the panel's here thoughts on when does fun become work and what sort of things do we need to watch out for so that we are gaining the productivity benefits and we're gaining the competitiveness and we're gaining all the good things about applying game principles, constructs, rules, engines to work without taking on the negative connotations.
Yeah, Michael, as soon as I read this article, I mean, it reminded me kind of, you know, our initial impetus for all these thoughts, gosh, I won't mention how many years ago, but, you know, the old Dancing with Wookiees thought, right? And how, you know, could I make a game to level up my Java programming skills as an example, right?
Yep.
And, you know, it would be so compelling and so engaging that every night I would go home and I would spend hours and hours playing the Java programming skilling up game. And the more that, you know, I've learned and thought about this over the years, it takes me right to where this article points me, to where if it's something that is overtly driven to a work-related task that is then measured as a business-related outcome in your day job activity as the receiver of the game, the mechanics, the engagement, everything else has to be, I believe, a lot higher and a lot more enjoyable to feed all the other aspects of what makes a game and not just a lesson or a task.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think Jesse Schnell also spoke to this, and he said, you know, if you make it something that you're forced to do, I mean, the essence of games are that you're being motivated to play intrinsically. Yep. And so when you try to make it a forced thing, people get disenfranchised. What are your thoughts, Tom?
Well, I'm a big believer in, you know, going way back to the book Homo Ludens, in the idea of the magic circle, that people, when they play a game, they're stepping into a different environment, you know, in the game from the kind of the normal world that they're living in. The rules are different. It's kind of the whole point of doing it, is to temporarily adjust the rules so that you get a different outcome than you would through the normal rules of working with your coworkers or whatever. And I think that if you make it part of the work and you're really being judged on the basis of how many badges or points or whatever you get, you've lost that division. And you've lost, I think, a lot of the power of the game. So for example, you know, there's a really interesting success story with the city of San Jose. It's not a work story, it's a political story, but I think this has great political applications as well, where they played a game called Buy a Feature in order to engage the community differently. They were having some serious budget issues and they wanted to have the community not just sit there and grumble about it, but really actively say, well, this is what we want to do. This is the kind of city of San Jose we want to emerge once we've figured out the hard budget decisions that we're making. And it's been successful enough. They've done it 3 years in a row, and it's something they do, you know, not every single day. It would lose its potency then. It would lose the excitement about it. It would lose a lot if it were just too regular. It's best if it's a magic circle that people can step into.
Yeah, agreed. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think also in the realm of gamification now, this is also a hot topic because people are thinking about, okay, what are the attributes that really motivates changes within user behavior? And if you only introduce things like sticks, right? If you don't play this and if you don't get at least 100 points, your pay is going to be docked or you're not going to be up for this next promotion. People are going to get upset, understandably upset. There has to be enough intrinsic value to the employees playing, to the people playing, that they want to play. They're not feeling forced into it.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thought because, you know, the object of work at the end of the day is to derive an economic benefit for the entity, or if you're in a nonprofit, for the mission of the organization, right? So the point that I think we're all on is that you want to get the objective completed as a byproduct of actually having fun while you're doing it.
Right. And you don't also want to insult people. I mean, that's the other thing I really bugs me sometimes about some of these proposals is, hey, let's turn this call center into a big pirate game. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, that would be a great running joke in Office Space 2.
Yeah. But can you steal the stapler? yeah, but, you know, one of the things that really gets me, and I think Tom, you hit right on it, is again, the intrinsic value of the game, and make that the thing that then drives, Michael, to your point, the business outcome, not the business outcome driving the value of the game. right? And that gets down to the back to the point of how do you engage people in such a way that they want to play? Yes, it may end up being that stick that you're talking about, Fader, that you got to get 100 points or you're not going to get your business rating this year at the level that you need to be. But if you only get 50 points, you might as well start, shipping your resume out the door. But how do you really tease that out? You know, working with a customer who has this basic desire, this basic belief that I need to have outcome X. I hear a lot about gamification. It sounds like it's the new way of getting it to happen. So let's just put badges on our internal social bookmarking site and life is good.
Yeah, there's some aspects of it that might work. You know, I think that there's the common sort of knowledge management problem of how do I find the person who's really an expert in something? And that's not too bad, but again, there are bad applications of it. And I think the good applications have been really short term. Excuse me. Like Microsoft has a language quality game, I think that's the name of it, that they run regularly when they have to translate the software that people internally at Microsoft can contribute to the really tedious job of translating into multiple languages and just checking the mm-hmm. after they run the automated translation, then they have people inside check it, and you get rewarded in points for how many bugs you find in the translation. But that's not every day, and it would be horrible to imagine imposing that on people every day
and just sitting down and doing it. Right. Yeah. I've seen examples of that work where there's like, you're entered into a contest where, you might get a chance to win a grill or, maybe some money will be donated to a particular charity of your choice or something, but it's using those kind of almost gambling type principles to say there's value in doing this. There's inherent value in doing this. And there's a way for you potentially to get some additional value for yourself. I think that's interesting. The thought that leapt to mind, and I keep typing things in the chat here too, is that games are all about optimization plays. If you're playing Monopoly or you're playing Field Runners or you're playing Risk, you're always trying to optimize your outcome from your perspective. So games, by their very nature, are better business process simplification vehicles because you're trying to get to your end goal and strip away the things that prevent you from getting to your end goal. So one of the concepts that was kind of rattling around the back of my head from the conversation a couple of moments ago was that people win when the process that they're trying to achieve is obtained or achieved faster and maybe with less effort. So this is an area where mandatory fun actually aligns well with what the individual interest would be, because they can get other things done, or they can get done the tasks they need to faster and move on to something else.
Yeah, I think, Michael, I think that makes a lot of sense. The idea about the optimization angle, right? And how do you improve a process, improve an outcome, right? So by focusing on the outcome driven, that helps drive the business value side of it again. We just need to make sure that you don't lose the aspect of the intrinsic value for the players of the game.
So the fun aspect is still there, right? Because people come to work, whether nonprofit, profit, what have you, government, et cetera, they come to work to get things done. They believe in what they're doing, and they're also compensated for what they're doing, in real or virtual ways, depending upon their nature, their employment. So the fun angle is still something to me that's there. So if something becomes mandatory fun, I think that the mandatory element really comes into focus when the game now gets in the way of getting done what needs to get done. If the pirate model, Tom, to your example, mm-hmm. let's all be avatars of various pirates, and we're going to be associated with different ships, and your ship is going to compete with my ship, and we're going to blow each other to smithereens depending on how fast we answer customer inquiries, and do we have people escalating us or not. Maybe that is a nice leaderboard thing. Maybe it's a complete distraction, doesn't help anyone whatsoever, and it becomes an impediment to actually getting the next set of calls done. And people think, okay, this is the mandatory fun. It's not helping me. I'm going to ignore it or actively work against it.
Yeah, and I think that this ultimately comes down to there are people who honestly don't have experience designing games who are maybe proposing some of these reward structures. I mean, there's an old board game design maxim. You're either designing for cause or you're designing for effect. It's either you're putting the players through a bunch of actions, kind of it's on their shoulders to do really, sometimes very complicated, onerous things. Like, you know, I'm playing a board game that simulates, the Second World War. I mean, there's a ton of those out there. And, you know, if it's super detailed and, you know, it tries to, you know, kind of then say, okay, you've got all these things you can do, go have fun. It's not actually very fun. Right, because it's going to be too much work after a certain point to try to extract any fun out of it. But we, you know, if the designer takes the time to really kind of think through what's the experience that people want, you're kind of designing for effect. Then the effect being then that people are having fun. You're abstracting things and streamlining them and so forth. And I just, you know, I don't, you know, I think that, you know, sometimes when people talk about these sorts of reward systems, they're not thinking, well, what am I really doing to keep it engaging for people? It's kind of just, you know, you make this sort of casual reference to Daniel Pink and it's all over.
And I think also you had mentioned earlier, Michael, specifically process optimization games. So I think the trick to those are iterative gameplay. It's not just playing once. It's you want people to come back, and you want them to come back again and again and again, and you want them to try this and you want them to try that. And if it's not by itself engaging, they're just not going to do that. They're going to say, okay, you know, I've played it once. That's my quota. I'm done. You know, I've checked off the little box.
Yeah, so Phaedra, I guess you know, with that idea, that replayability idea, and you think about some of the popular games on mobile devices or handhelds, and the fact that non-business related games have to constantly provide more content or updates to get that replayability, except for just a very thin set of games, right? Most games are providing new content and new things to drive that playability. Unlike, you know, and I'll pick a really trivial example, Monopoly, right? Monopoly might change the board pieces, and recently they got rid of jail. But the game yes, that happened this week. There's a big announcement about it because kids don't have the attention span anymore, and that slows down the game. but anyway, but you know, the playability, the mechanics, the value of the game has been, what, 80, 90 years now? 75, somewhere in that range for that game Monopoly, I think 75 or more, that other than changing look, the playability has not changed effectively. Versus, you know, pick your favorite MMO, or, you know, your favorite Angry Birds edition, and they're constantly putting out new content to keep people engaged in the game. So do we have that similar challenge in business process games?
I think that's an excellent question. I would love to be – I think we do. I think there's going to be that challenge. I think ultimately when I've talked to clients and they talk about their dream of what a process optimization game should look like, they want people to be able to come in and play not just one role, the process optimizer role, right, which you could say is the good guy, the protagonist, but also to come in and play the stressors to the process, you know, the antagonists. Right? I'm going to play nature and I'm going to put a tsunami here, here, and here and follow this earthquake up with this other one. You see what I'm saying? So how is it that one might be able to create a process optimization game that allows you to just really be able to experiment for fun? Like, can this break this process? What if I did this? I mean, there's something inherently fun about even trying to break a process. I mean, I've seen my nephew play city sim games, and the first thing he wants to do is set the city on fire. You know, how is it that we can break something? And there's something
fun about
that,
right? That's where you need
cow tipper. Right?
You need cow tipper for that, so it can tip over the lamp.
Phaedra, right. you sound so gleeful when you're talking about that. You're scaring me.
There are destructive tendencies in everyone, but the point is that people who can tell the difference between a game and reality are always curious to see what happens if they light the fuse or they open the red door or they press the button that's marked don't press.
Well, maybe right. maybe the challenge for process optimization games is not that it's a single game cycle, but that the game is almost like an MMO ongoing where each player comes in and can affect the simulation. You know, you just kind of over time, because if you think about what a business process is, it's not a static process. It's a series of actions and activities that drive a specific outcome that you're constantly doing. So you're constantly tweaking and reoptimizing it because there are external forces, market forces, changes, in technology, changes in business relationships, you know, et cetera, economic conditions that change that, you know, a perfectly optimized, business process for making buggy whips is still out of business, right? So how do you optimize that process? So now you're in the transportation industry.
Well, and how do you make it enough fun so that people come back and play it, right? So, you know, the tiny bit of research I've done around this shows that the sports games are oftentimes, you know, large, successful, ongoing franchises. You know, think about Madden football. You know, think about the tennis games, et cetera. I mean, you can go down the list. People like to play sports games because the sports games, you know, while the game is always the same, the outcome can always be weird, wacky, or different. And this is why people like to still go in such large numbers to live sporting events and see Major League basketball or baseball or anything else. So how do we make a process game as intriguing as that? That's an interesting trick, because mm-hmm. sports games generate, you know, all the people who are like playing fantasy sports, and I can't talk about that. I'm not one of them. Small ball. Yeah, exactly. that was fun.
A fun game. And the thing is, you came back and the content did change over time because you were impacting the simulation.
Yes, yes. It's a small ball for those who may not have heard of it, and I haven't played it since we played it, Michael, which was now several years ago.
Many years ago.
A baseball simulation game where you would train your players. You can give them various names, and then you would play your teams against other teams, and as they gain experience, your hitters would hit better, your catchers would catch better, and you could spend time having them work up their skills in various areas. So it was kind of fun because you had some, you know, graphics to look at. It wasn't just like, oh, batter number 7 has now upped their hitting ability from 6.2 to 6.3. You know, if it were that fun, I wouldn't have played it at all.
A lot of people just don't like fantasy sports, right? I mean, yeah. Phaedra made this point yesterday when we were talking when I had her guest on my podcast to be published. And, you know, that really in game design, you have to take into account that people are different. They have different motivations. I think for people like me who have been playing board games for a long time, that's very familiar territory, that there are some people who come to play to win. You know, they're absolutely motivated to win. There are some people who play it just for the social experience. Other people treat it like a puzzle that they're trying to solve. You know, it's probably, you know, at bottom, the explanation for why Zynga hasn't done better. I mean, not everybody wants to sit and spam their friends about Farmville. Some people do, but others don't.
Yeah, I do find one of the most annoying things on our favorite social network, FriendFace, that the spamming by all the games, right? I mean, as soon as I see anything from anybody on that feed that's a game spam, I immediately block that game. And so it takes away, again, the idea is to get people engaged, but it comes to a point where it actually reduces the value.
But if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it.
I know.
It obviously works.
I'm weird that way. So, but Tom, what's the name of that podcast?
Okay, it's the same name as the site. So it's Serious Games at Work. Launching soon. Actually, Phaedra's my first guest, Mike.
Excellent.
So that, you know, in the next couple of days, sure. I'll be posting it. Yeah,
you couldn't have had a better guest.
Yes. I could.
Oh, no, right. You're biased.
And I threw a weird question at her, and she just kind of deftly caught it and threw it back at me. It was really a joy to hear.
See, it was just playing a game.
What's the weirdest question you'd ever had on a podcast interview?
What's the weirdest question? Oh, God, it was awful. I was asked the question, okay, tell me what – so you say games are not the panacea. Serious games are not the panacea for everything. So tell me, in what space would a serious game not be able to really provide value? And I blurted out completely unknowingly. I was like, well, I would think that balancing a budget would be very difficult with a game. And of course, you know, then the state of California comes out with all this news about how they're using budget games. So it was like a big oops.
Yeah, Phaedra, I'm sorry I asked you that question on last week's show. No.
That was a hard one. That was a very difficult one.
Yeah, it's funny.
Maybe we should have Tom answer that.
Well, I was about to do that same thing because, you know, there's a podcast that I listen to called The Dinner Party Download, which is, you know, one of these fun, interesting things going on. And they actually ask every guest two questions. One, what's the one question that you're tired of being asked?
Yeah.
Which is a great way of getting them to answer that same question. And then the second question is, you know, tell us something we don't know. It could be about you, the universe, you know, anything. So go for it. Tom, what's the one question that you hate being asked?
Are people going to worry that it's a game, right? Are people going to treat it as trivial? And it's anything but, you know, I think certainly seen a lot of situations more often than not where actually the impetus for the serious game comes from the executive level or, you know, somebody who you'd expect to be the one to kind of sniff at it and say, ooh, game, how could I possibly take that seriously? I think we're kind of in a lot of organizations past that, not everybody, but I think there are people who are really looking to be, you know, as I said before, you know, changing the rules of work or politics or whatever, and you know, they're very open to the idea of a game. So I think that's maybe the question I would like to stop answering.
So you don't like the one of, hey, so if I just put badges and a leaderboard up, I'm not doing gamification?
Oh.
That's one of my
favorites.
That's
pretty bad.
Yeah. So but now, Tom, all you have to do is say, well, I'll just refer you to this podcast and you can just have the answer you want.
Okay.
And you can play it again and again, and you'll hear it at the same
time. I would also say, actually, to go back to one of your earlier episodes about RFPs, I think the one, you know, the people who are asking, can I do this on the cheap? I think that that's a bad idea. So it's a lot like, you know, since I do a lot with Agile development, actually I'm at the Agile conference next week, you know, people will say, you know, do we really need to get training and coaching for this? It's like, okay, you want disruptive innovation, but you don't want to pay for it at all. Maybe you should reconsider what you're doing. And I heard echoes. Yes, I've heard echoes of that in your rant.
If it's really going to impact your business, you need to do the investments that are appropriate. Rant on.
Sorry to get you guys fired up again.
Well, it is getting to be budget season. So, you know, I think we hit the main points that we wanted to cover today. Is there anything else that we're seeing that we want to make sure we
You know what we haven't done in a long time? We haven't done a savings throw. There's a new Kickstarter that just kicked off. I believe it was yesterday, from friends of mine at a company called Emotive, which developed a brain-scanning headset about 5 years ago. I actually had the opportunity back at GDC in 2008, to present with them when they launched their product. And there's been way, way cool stuff going on in research and education around using their headset to, you know, help people who are disabled to do, you know, interact with computers, play games. There's examples of people using the headset to control an AR drone and flying it around. I actually saw that at Macworld this last year. You know, really cool stuff. Well, they've just kicked off a Kickstarter for a brand new headset, and we'll have a link in the show notes that doesn't require a lot of the complexity of the first headset. They've got a new Kickstarter. We'll put it in the show notes for a really cool next gen of this headset, and it is awesome looking.
I just wanted to let you know I've just pledged my support as well. So I'll look forward to seeing one of these arriving at my doorstep in March.
Yes.
Awesome. So that will be really super, super cool because I know the kind of work you put into this, and the idea of thinking my way through work is really quite good.
Unlike most days where I try not to think at work.
Yeah, so maybe my saving throw of the day, and I've talked about this a little bit recently, but I'll highlight it once again, is I've been a Jawbone Up user since the beginning of the year with one hiccup for a while when my Up band failed and I had to go through the process of getting it replaced under warranty, blah, 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 blah. So long story, but I have it again now. And I'm really enjoying using it. I'm enjoying the team approach on it too. So this the Up band is something that you wear, and it helps you to monitor your sleeping habits. You know, when did you go to sleep? When did you get up? And it lets you know whether you were in deep REM sleep or you were having light sleep. So that's kind of cool that you can see that as well. And it uses a vibrating function to awaken you at the optimal point in your sleep cycle so that you'll feel the most refreshed when you wake up. You know how sometimes you feel groggy because you slept too late, or you might feel groggy because your alarm went off right when you're the deepest REM sleep possible. So this gives you like 15 minutes on either side of your requested wake-up time to pick the optimal time to wake you up. So I really enjoy that, and I think that's a big plus. And that spawned a tweet that I put out earlier this week saying that for mobile devices, maybe the way a way of doing alerts and signaling for wearable and subdermal computing might be to vibrate on prime number schedules. So I thought that was kind of fun.
Awesome.
Very cool. Very cool.
So, you know, that would be neat. Phaedra, how about you for a saving throw?
Saving throw. Speaking of healthcare, this past week I played a very cool hospital process optimization game from Breakaway Games, so Doug Whatley's company, who Tom mentioned earlier. They made this really cool game where, in essence, you've got a hospital that has a whole set of resources and you've got to respond to different kinds of disasters, whether it's a bomb threat, whether it's a plague that has infested the city, an emergency C-section, all hell breaks loose in this hospital, and you've got to figure out how you're going to stack up beds and use resources in a way to make sure that fewer people die and you maximize your environment. I thought that was very cool. That's the first time I had seen that done in healthcare per se. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm sure we'll get tweets and emails saying, no, that's been done before. But I really liked what I saw. A lot of interesting things happening in the realm for games for health. Discussions with regards to the integration of clinical lab avatars in the electronic healthcare record. Some very cool things. So I'll keep my eye on that and keep it guys posted. Tom, what about you?
So mine would be Endgame Eurasia, which is an iOS game. I don't know if there's an Android version of it, but it was originally Endgame Syria. And the reason I'm bringing this up is I long ago stopped watching the news on television because I found it really frustratingly content-free. And even the news, you know, the printed news sometimes does a very bad job of explaining foreign conflicts, aside from issues like tax reform and so forth. And it kind of, it's always, you know, fighting happened today and there are refugees, and you don't hear, you know, kind of anything about the internal mechanics of the conflict, who the parties are, what they're really fighting for, what are the choices they face. And that's what this game is about. It's a damn shame that the Apple Store initially rejected it as Endgame Syria.
I remember hearing that. Yes.
Right. Yeah. For kind of silly reasons. But anyway,
it came back, didn't it?
Well, it came back as Endgame Eurasia.
Yeah, okay, right. That's what they did, yes.
Why did they reject it? What happened? I don't remember this story.
Because it was about a controversial political topic, and they had some policy about, you know, you can't target a particular
country.
Person or country, yeah. Or whatever. Okay, whatever.
Oh, okay.
So in any case, in the game, you're playing cards each turn that are, you know, initially, let's say, some political decisions. But then you're fighting and you play your fight cards. And in the battles, you're making choices about, okay, do I want to feel, let's say, these guys who are militants who are going to really shoot up the place and cause a lot of backlash against against my force because you're playing the rebels in the Syrian conflict. Or do I want to, you know, play somebody else who's a little more moderate and but less, maybe less capable of taking on the threat that I'm facing right now? Anyway, it was it started to kind of show people there are some choices people have to make in these conflicts that aren't black and white. And you know, it's not a perfect simulation of the conflict by any stretch of the imagination. It is a game with one particular point that it's trying to make, but I would love to see a multiplayer version of that. I'd like to see other conflicts modeled in a similar way. I thought it was a terrific little game. So that was Endgame Eurasia.
Eurasia, yeah.
Very cool. Very cool.
The trick for that game, I think, to be successful is going to be marketing. We actually here locally had a gaming studio that tried to make a game. It was running on a first-person shooter gaming engine that focused specifically on the Battle of Fallujah. Mm-hmm. And what happened, I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but what happened was they wanted to bring in all of these documentaries. They wanted to interview people from both sides of the fence. They really wanted it to be more of a historical significance game rather than, you know, you're just going to play through this and it's going to be a first-person shooter and there's going to be a lot of blood and gore. Like they really did want to insert
truth and reconciliation,
more,
really, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mm. But they never talked about that in the marketing. Like the marketing people who took it up went and said, oh, yeah, it's going to be, you know, the other end of the spectrum. And because of the immediate backlash from the public, the publisher dropped them like a hotcake. So if they had gone instead and said, all right, here's what you're going to learn from this game. Here's what we got. You tie it to the documentaries. I think it could have very likely had a different evolution.
Interesting.
So, Tom, we wanted to hit the website discussion right before we close.
Oh, sure. Okay. So just to mention the kind of the reason for the website, seriousgamesatwork.org, I've just been, since I've been following this topic for a while, realized there are a lot of different things we call serious games and gamification. There are a lot of different success stories out there, but there's nothing that kind of pulls them together. And we're at that sort of crossing the chasm moment. You know, when we want to go past the initial pioneers who are willing to take the risk to try this stuff out and to people who are really not going to be able to sell it to their organization unless they can see that others have trod the same path before and been successful with games. And also to make it clear which kind of game is appropriate for the type of challenge that you're facing. Is it a role-playing game? Is it a computer-based gamification exercise? What is it? You know, and you know that's you know, again, kind of the purpose of seriousgamesatwork.org, to get that set of success stories, that set of games, and to make sense of them. And if anybody listening has stories like that they want to send my way, I'd be very interested in them and possibly publishing them. Just drop me a line at tomgrantgamer@gmail.com.
Excellent. And you know, one of the great things is there's a huge community around serious games and gaming. I mean, as we've seen through some of the conferences and the discussions. So I think there's lots of great content here. And as we've already talked about on the show, is there's a lot of interest in business to make sure that not only is this a reality, but that the value is there for them and that they can really, you know, drive their business forward by leveraging this.
And I'm always surprised about some of the success stories I trip over. If you can get them all in one place that everybody can refer to, I'm just trying to be that kind of resource for people who want to make serious games a bigger success.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for joining us and having this discussion with us. And really look forward to the launch of your site and your first podcast with your special guest, Phaedra.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's been a real delight to be with you guys today.
Absolutely.
Thank you for
Tom.
Coming, Tom. Yep. Thanks, Michael. And Michael, we're so glad we got to actually have all of our co-hosts on the same call.
Two weeks in a row.
I know. It's amazing.
It's a trend.
It is. We've got to keep it going. Remember, 7 data points is a trend.
Okay.
And with that, we'll talk to you all next week. And don't forget to drop us an email or easiest thing, go to our website at games@work.biz. GamesAtWork.biz, and let us know what you think and any ideas you might have for future shows. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thanks. See ya. Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.